Houston, we have a podcast. Welcome to the official podcast of the NASA Johnson Space Center, episode 383, Mission Control, Special Operations. I'm Kenna Pell, and I'll be your host today. On this podcast, we bring in the experts, scientists, engineers, and astronauts, all to let you know what's going on in the world of human spaceflight and more. The Mission Control Center, or MCC for short, is the iconic epicenter of spaceflight operations. It takes a large, talented team in order to assure the safety and success of any mission, whether to low Earth orbit or beyond. You may have seen depictions of Mission Control in the movies or seen video of it during a NASA broadcast. The Mission Control team is there 24/7, 365, monitoring all of the systems and activities aboard our orbiting laboratory. Each day is covered by three shifts of controllers who do a handover between to ensure that everything runs smoothly. This is the fifth episode in a series we're dedicating to exploring the roles within MCC in the International Space Station Flight Control Room. In this episode, we'll be covering four console positions, including Visiting Vehicle Officer, or VVO, with Dori Tomiko, Integration and Systems Engineer, or ICE, with Lisa Harris-Redman, Extravehicular Activities, or EVA, with Lucas Widener, and Robotics Operations Officer, or ROBO, with Alyssa Sines. These flight controllers cover what we're calling special operations. Their console positions are unique in that they are activated during specific dynamic operational events, whether that's monitoring station's traffic of arriving or departing spacecraft, venturing out into the vacuum of space on a spacewalk, or operating station's robotic helper. Let's dive into the action with special operations. Recorders to flight speed. VVO?
Go.
ICE?
Go.
EVA?
Go.
ROBO?
Go.
We are Go for Houston. We have a podcast. Welcome to Houston, we have a podcast. So we called today's episode Special Operations. We've got a packed house here, and a lot of times you all aren't on console until there's action. Let's go around and let's meet you all. Can you say your name, your console, talk about how you got to be where you're at, maybe mention your college degrees? Let's start with VVO.
So my name is Dori Tomiko. I'm a VVO, a Visiting Vehicle Officer. So we're partially in charge of safety whenever there's a vehicle coming to the space station. I went to college at Purdue University. I have an undergrad degree in aeronautical and astronautical engineering with a minor in communications. And then I went on to get my master's in leadership from Northeastern.
I think we'll get to that a little bit later about how your training in communications and leadership has helped in your role. And so let's go over to ICE with Lisa.
I'm Lisa Harris-Redman from the ICE group, the Integration and Systems Engineer. I focus on visiting vehicles coming to and from the space station. And while they're there and visiting, I have a degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Colorado at Boulder with a minor in Russian language and a master's degree in space studies from the University of North Dakota.
Now over to Lucas with EVA.
Hi, I'm Lucas Widener with the EVA console. EVA stands for extravehicular activity, which is when the crew is outside upgrading or repairing the space station, and our job is to keep them safe while they do so. I have an undergraduate degree from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona, in aerospace engineering, and that brought me here to NASA, and I've been here about 5.5 years.
I have to say, he has the coolest shirt on right now, buttoned down with planets and rockets. It's really cool. Thanks, Lucas. And now let's go over to ROBO. Alyssa.
Hi, my name is Alyssa Sines. I'm a member of the ROBO group. It's the Robotic Operations Console. We are in charge of sending commands to the robotics aboard ISS and also training crew to operate the robotics on ISS as well. My background is in aerospace engineering. I got my undergraduate degree from Texas A&M, Giggum Aggies. And a few years later, I got my master's in space operations from the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs.
Now that we've gotten to know what each of your flight control positions and mission control do, let's dive in a little deeper. And I kind of want to get to know, instead of a fifth grade, 10,000 foot level, a little bit more about each of your positions. So let's start with Dori with VVO. What type of data are you using when you guide a visiting vehicle?
So we rely mostly on data coming from the vehicle. So for my console position, we're looking at where the vehicle is relative to ISS. So we call the path that it's on the trajectory. So we're checking the trajectory all the time. And we are using data usually from the vehicle sensors. Usually they have a sensor suite, at least two different kinds, so that we can have some checks and balances. And so we're watching data from those sensors to figure out where it is. We're also in charge of GNC, guidance, navigation, and control, which is where it is, where it wants to go, and how it's going to get there. And so the where it is that trajectory. Where it wants to go is its targeting. It's coming to station, but we need to make sure it does that safely. And then how it's going to get there is propulsion. And so we watch the jets, and we're making sure that those are performing correctly as well. And then I mentioned a little bit about independent. We also help develop and then train the crew to use the software that they use to watch the vehicle coming in. They use ISS cameras and some graphics we overlay on top of it using RoboSystem. And that allows them to independently monitor the vehicle as well. So we'd like to make sure all the pieces line up so that we know the truth about where the vehicle is and that everything is safe.
You explained that so well. I'm going to be writing that down for later use. What about ephemeris, if I'm saying that right?
You are, yeah. So that's when the vehicle provider gives us data about where it is. That's usually used when it's a little farther away from station. Okay. So I know you guys talked to Topo recently. We do kind of a similar job in some aspects with visiting vehicles. They're more responsible when it's farther away, and then we're more responsible when it's closer. And so generally, once the vehicle gets close, it starts talking to us about where it is relative to ISS versus where it is just in space.
Okay, so does your role really kick in when you're around that approach ellipsoid or a little bit further out?
Good vocab use, yeah. So depends on the vehicle a little bit. For crewed vehicles, we also have responsibility for launch and some of the far field activities. But generally, the handover starts when they're going to start using any of our assets, whether that's the comm system, whether we have to change our attitude, or whether we're going to have the crew involved. And so we kick in a couple hours before they get to the approach ellipsoid.
Okay. That was really helpful. And the only reason I knew what ephemeris data was is from our Spot the Station app.
There you go. Yeah.
Topo helps with that. And so you can see about 2 weeks out exactly where the station's going to be and get those notifications straight to your phone. So with autonomous capability, so yesterday I had the opportunity to sit on console for, at the time this podcast was recorded, for Dragon's undocking from space station yesterday on the commercial resupply services 31st. Cargo mission. So it had undocked. And I'm wondering what, when it's in that kind of autonomous capability mode, or even when it's arriving, right? What are you looking out for?
Yeah, so our hope is that the vehicle stays in autonomous mode all the time. Even the ones that the crew is on board and they can manually operate, we always hope that we get to do it automated. That's the ideal goal, with the vehicle telling us where it wants to go and how it wants to get there, and the ground or the crew on board providing different gateways to make sure that what it wants to do is safe. So we're checking its operations, checking its systems, making sure that the decisions that it's making and the data it's using to make those decisions are good, and then stepping in if we need to. And if there's crew on board, they also have the option to step in as well. So for a Soyuz or a Dragon or a CST.
So hoping it stays autonomous, and then you kick in when maybe it isn't.
Exactly.
What about even when the hooks, when they unhook, when they're undocking? That's fully autonomous as well.
Yep. So for grappling vehicles, when we start using RoboSystem, the crew is involved and the actual operation of grappling is done by humans. But our hope for all the approach and even for the docking is that it's all done automated.
Got it. Okay. And then you'd mentioned this. Are all VVOs trained on specific vehicles or all?
Yeah, so it's a little of both. The VVO role is somewhat generic in that the pieces I talked about, you can do that for any vehicle. And so we often have the ability to step in and on a more quiescent part of the mission. So when it's flying or just doing burns farther away, we have more VVOs that can step in and do it. But then we kind of get expertise in a specific vehicle or a couple of vehicles. So the actual docking day or the grappling day is going to be done by a specific set of VVOs who have done additional training and gained additional knowledge to have more expertise on that specific vehicle.
Okay. And there's so many vehicles. I know actually for the first time in history in 2024, we had three different vehicles, spacecraft, that carried humans to the space station docked at the same time. So with Starliner, Dragon, and Soyuz, that was a cool fact from this year and a piece of history that your team gets to work with.
Absolutely. And we've got new cargo vehicles coming up as well. So Sierra is going to be coming. JAX is bringing a new vehicle, HTVX. And then Axiom is going to bring a module that, until it gets there, acts as a visiting vehicle. And so we can help Cygnus and Dragon with their and Progress with their current cargo ops and help lighten that load a little bit for them.
That's really exciting. Okay. Thanks, Dory. Let's go over to ICE with Lisa. I'm going to ask a few more questions. So are you primarily on console during arrival and docking and berthing?
So we come for a combination of things. So we arrive shortly before we turn on the comm systems. We check those out. We'll do a series of checks to make sure that the visiting vehicle's control center commands are getting through all the way to the vehicle. And then we will support from that point forward all the way through until we have captured, either captured or docked, and integrated all the systems on board, do power checks, do comm checks with the internal systems on ISS. And then if there's additional payload activities for external payloads, et cetera, things like that, we'll stay for that. And then we will go into what's called quiescent mode. And then we'll only come in for certain specific activities for the crewed vehicles. They'll wake them up for do some system checks and things like that. We'll support that, or any other special activities that are vehicle specific. And then we will come back at the end of that mission. They all have kind of varied lengths of mission to, again, turn on the comm system, do a series of systems checks for the vehicles, and support all the way through until it leaves the keep out sphere. And in the case of some of the crewed vehicles, until those are on the ground to ensure that our crew is safe and the systems are operating the way we would expect them to.
I didn't think about that because the spacecraft are docked there for months at a time, right? And so once, I guess the job is done, once it's docked, it's safely there, then it goes into that quiescent mode. But then you have to come back on to turn it back on and check the different systems. It's just something I didn't think about.
We do keep an eye on it. It's, you know, it's still alive and it's passing health and status telemetry and environmental and electrical, all sorts of things. And I can log into that at any time and take a look, even from my desk at home, which is really kind of neat. If we have experienced an issue with the spacecraft for some reason, it's rare, but it does happen, we'll come in and support the visiting vehicle team and the ISS flight control team to save that vehicle and make sure that it's back in its nominal state or the best we can get it to.
And so Dragon, it's on pressurized trunk. It carries big payloads. And recently we carried, Dragon carried a Codex up there. Do you work with Robo? Are you on console and you work with Robo when they're taking that out to install it on station?
It really depends on what integrated system it is with the Dragon itself or the systems that are holding that in there and what's needed as far as cameras and switch throws and things like that to release the payload. It really depends on what the operation is. But yes, generally we'll support external payload operations. The Dream Chaser that's coming up, that'll have some capabilities as well that has some systems that will need our assistance with the Robo team. And we provide the coordination between the visiting vehicle team and the robotics team as they need to make sure that the Robos can focus on their job and the visiting vehicles doing their job. And then we're the go-between between the two to make sure that all the systems are going smoothly and the procedures are running integrated well.
That was fascinating. And I did not think about all the things you mentioned about kind of restarting and making sure it was all good for departure. Okay, let's go over to Lucas with EVA. I had a few questions on what all that you do, and especially when it comes to the lead up to a spacewalk. How many months ahead are you planning for a day of spacewalk procedures?
Yeah, so the fun part about spacewalks is it's people performing them up on the space station. And we really want to make sure that they are fully trained, not only in the tasks that they're doing, but also in safety. So all of that starts about 2 years before they launch, when they're assigned to their mission. So we do a whole suite of NBL runs and classes where they get to practice not only getting their suits ready for the spacewalks, but the specific operations they're going to be doing outside. So the first two-thirds of that training is kind of generic, getting them ready to prepare the spacewalks and then develop the skills that they need to perform the majority of the tasks that they would see on the space station. So a lot of repairing our common electronics and cooling and power equipment up there. And then while they're doing those tasks, we will throw all these malfunctions at them, pretend that their spacesuits are failing or their buddy goes incapacitated and they have to learn how to pull them back to the airlock safely and recover from any of those cases. So we make sure that they have all of those skills really nailed down. And then about 6 months before launch, we start to focus on what specific tasks are planned for the six-month period they're on board the space station. And because we're always looking at what are the things that are breaking on the space station, what are the upgrades we want to make, and kind of trying to fit all those puzzle pieces into a 6.5-hour EVA and figuring out which of those tasks pairs well together. So usually about a year before the spacewalk, which is right towards the end of the crew's training, is when we have somewhat of an idea of what that'll be. And so we'll start showing them that specifically in the NBL so that they're prepared for those tasks. And then as they launch to the space station and as it gets closer to about a month, we're refining all those procedures on the ground. We're having more of their crewmates that are still on the ground do more NBL runs, practicing those skills and really nailing in all of the specific choreography. Because in that 6.5 hours, we have to plan out every single tether that they use and every single bolt that they drive, we have to really be thinking about. And what do we do if that goes wrong? So that process takes months and it's a lot of planning and we have a lot of folks supporting us as we come up with that overall plan.
I like, if I have this right, how you mentioned maybe about a year out, you're kind of doing generic training with the crew, maybe planning for contingencies or hopefully not planning, but how to handle contingencies if they come up, kind of more the generic getting to know it, you know, in the NBL. But then you said at 6 months, it kind of gets more granular. So they get, you know what the space station needs at that point. Would you say that's about right? So at first it's kind of general with the crew. We know they're going to station and then it gets a little bit more granular on the task.
Yeah, and that time frame, of course, can change depending on what the specific issue is. And sometimes it'll be less than 3 months before a spacewalk and something breaks on board. And we get asked, well, does this fit in any of your planned spacewalks? Can we go do this extra task? And so we have to really hurry to do some NBL runs or take past experience that we have, figure out if that's feasible to add in, if it keeps the two crew members close enough to each other to where it's safe, they could rescue each other, all of those little things. And then again, we just take as much information as we have at the time to build the best plan that we have. And then as it gets closer, we firm up a lot more of those answers. But there are some spacewalks where it's a higher priority contingency case where something very important will fail and it can be less than 2 weeks between that failure happening and our team on the ground getting ready, our crew members studying and getting their suits ready, and us actually going outside and fixing that. And all of the crew members are trained on kind of those really important things. So that was part of that early generic training so that if that happens, we have a good enough plan to where we can go out and be successful.
Got it. Okay. What does the makeup of the team look like? So when we're talking about kind of that generic EVA spacewalk training, is that the same team? And then when you get into the more specifics, is that a team that's assigned to a certain spacewalk?
Yeah, so there's two main sides to the EVA office, and the first side is the systems side, and this is the side that manages the spacesuits and the airlock. So that's basically the team that gets the suits and everything ready for us to go outside and keeps the crew safe while we're out there. So we're monitoring suit data while they're outside, and if anything with the suit looks funny, we're figuring out a plan to get them safely back inside. And then the other side of the house, the task side, which is the side that I'm focusing on right now, is what we're doing outside and actually accomplishing the work when we have the functioning spacesuits and airlock. So there will be team members from both sides working together on training the crew to start. So there will be folks in our office that are assigned to a specific missions crew. So they will train that crew from the start to the end, make sure that they see everything they need to for their 6-month assignment on the space station. And then it's usually a different team that's the ones planning the actual spacewalk. So the task side has to start that planning a lot earlier, like I mentioned. On the system side, it's a very similar path to get the suits ready for each spacewalk. So they don't really care what we're doing outside. It's more of just in the month or so before the spacewalk, actually doing the work to get all those spacesuits ready and get everything properly configured before they go out. But the task team has been developing that plan for months. And then, like I mentioned, once we get within about a month of the spacewalk, that's when it really starts to get busy. That's when the crew on board is actually setting things up using those procedures and the products that we developed ahead of time. And then during the we call it the execute day of EVA. That's when those planning teams from both sides are on console. And then we have one EVA flight controller in the front room, the main mission control center, that is talking to both the task and the system side during the EVA. And they've been kind of overseeing all of that prep as well.
Very cool. I know we talk about ops plan and how the crew's day is really kind of built into 5-minute increments, but what you guys do for the specific spacewalks, I mean, that's down to the hand movement, the tether, like that is really, really to the nitty gritty with for what the 6 to 8 hour time frame. Thanks, Lucas. That was a great overview. Alyssa, let's go over to you with Robo. I did tell Tim Braithwaite from Canadian Space Agency that I would shout him out for being the first Robo. But can you tell us about CSA's involvement in this console position?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of my favorite things about the Robo Group is that we're actually an international group. So on any given day, the robotic team might be some NASA flight controllers and might be flight controllers from the Canadian Space Agency. So either here in Houston or up in Canada. They have a control center up there that they can command to ISS Robotics as well. And they'll come down. Our Canadian counterparts will come down to Houston for training. We also go up to Canada for training as well. And yeah, we have really close relationships with them as well. And it's a really cool collaboration aspect of Robo. So CSA, their contribution to the ISS was the robotic system. So some of the different components of ISS robotics is the Space Station Remote Manipulator System, or SSRMS. You'll also hear it referred to as Canadarm2. The first Canada arm was on the shuttle, of course. The other component we have is a special purpose dextrous manipulator. We also call it Dextr for short, or SPDM. SPDM does some of the more dextrous tasks on station. So if there is some kind of electronics box that might fail, instead of having, you know, a whole EVA spin up, if we can do it robotically, that's always the preference. Save the crew's day for other tasks. We also have a mobile-based system that allows our robotics to move completely across ISS. So we have quite a bit of access to different areas. So we work closely with our visiting vehicle teams, for example, when we're maneuvering a payload out of, let's say, a Dragon trunk and then installing it to ISS, we can use Dextr and SSRMS for those tasks.
And so when you're doing a task like that, are the folks in Canada at their Mission Control Center also in the loop? So you've got the folks here in Houston and them?
Yeah, definitely. We have engineering support located in Canada as well. It just kind of depends how the shift works out, who's supporting from Canada, who's supporting here from Houston, but it's usually a mixed bag of folks for sure.
I love that. Okay. Do you have a favorite EVA or spacewalk that you've worked?
Yeah, definitely. So I was a part of the iROSA EVA team, and that was a robotically supported EVA. So we work really closely with our friends over in EVA to plan the robotic trajectories that will actually carry crew from, you know, one part of station to another. And we are able to put a crew member on the end of the arm and fly them around station. And that's actually something that the crew will support. So they're the ones flying the arm versus a lot of our other operations are ground control focused. But that's always an EVA day is always a very exciting day to work. And it's cool seeing all of your trajectories that you designed now carrying a crew member in space around the ISS. And It's I got to be a part of, you know, upgrading the ISS with new solar arrays for that particular EVA. So that was probably one of my favorite assignments I've gotten to do in recent years.
So cool. And if you haven't seen the photos of Woody Hoberg actually on the arm while they were doing the installation, they are so good.
Yeah, they're fun.
Okay, so a lot of times in our office, in the external relations office, we take folks on protocol tours, and we take them to the flight control room, the mission control center, the viewing room, right? So we'll see you guys all on console. And a lot of times they ask, what are the different symbols, like the bat on ADCO's console? What do those stand for? And so I wanted to ask if any of you, are there any traditions or anything that you'd want to share? And feel free to chime in.
So Dory and I, on the BBO and the ICE console, we like to put different models of the different spaceships that are visiting the space station at that time. At the ICE console for the Cygnus, we'll put a little swan, or we have a couple of different dragons based on which dragon it is, if it's cargo or a crewed dragon. And so we kind of have a little fun with toys at our console. And then she's got more interesting toys at hers.
We try to have a model of the vehicle that's up there all the time. And so sometimes that's Legos, sometimes they're 3D printed. There are some really cool folks out there who will look at a vehicle and design a Lego model for that specific vehicle. And it's very intricate and very detailed. And so we try to have one of those on console for any vehicle that we've got supporting. So you might not always see them, but behind us, there's a little table. And recently it's been nice. There are lots of those little vehicles up there because we've been really busy this year.
And before CRS, or Commercial Resupply Services, what did you guys have there instead of Dragons and Cygnus and the Swan shuttle? What were you putting on there?
So our Russian counterparts have been coming to and from the space station for a long time. And so we've had a great relationship with them for many, many years. And so we've always got a little Soyuz or a Progress that's around, because there's always at least a handful of those on board station.
Gotcha. I made a face like, duh, what kind of question was that? But cool. I love that. And how about EVA? When I was sitting there, and Robo, when I was sitting in mission control yesterday, I saw a cannon arm on, I think it was Robo's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe we do have a little 3D model on our console. And we also have a little flag stand with the U.S. flag and the Canadian flag as well, just to kind of show the international aspect of our console.
Love that. How about EVA?
The EVA console has a little Lego minifigure in a spacesuit on top of the console, which is pretty fun, a representation of what we do outside. One other thing that the EVA console does that the public doesn't really get to see is that when we're developing spacewalks, there tends to be a theme or a mascot that just gets created at some point during the development. And so we like to carry those forward and have callbacks. So in the week or two leading up to a spacewalk, we have these conferences with the astronauts where we talk through our plan and any things that we're specifically worried about, just being sure we're all on the same page. And so sometimes we'll like wear funny shirts that call back to that theme, or we'll bring in little mascots with us for those conferences just to add a little bit of humor into our serious topics.
Very cool.
The one thing we all hope isn't on our console is the gremlin.
Okay, I've heard about this. Can you explain?
Yeah, so there's a little gremlin stuffed animal, and whoever's console has been dealing with the most headache recently will often find the gremlin on their console. And so when you come in to start your shift, it's always a good idea to look in at your sign and make sure there's no gremlin there so you know what kind of day you're walking into.
That's funny. Okay. Well, we have referred to this episode as special operations because your jobs on console usually kick in when there are dynamic operational events. Let's talk about how you all interact during a mission. In terms of working together, VVO and ICE, can you talk about that?
Sure. We actually work together quite closely in the pre-flight phase and all the way up through the when BBO goes off console. They're done once they capture, and they'll stick around for a couple other things. But we spend a lot of time reviewing safety protocols, safety information. They rely heavily on the comm system that we maintain between the two vehicles. They're also, that she talked about instrumentation, that comm system's also providing some vehicle positional information to them as well as providing information for the robotics overlays for the crew. So everybody's really interested in that comm system and then that's working properly. We talk a lot to the robotics team, especially for Cygnus, that we can get power from the robotics arm to get a little additional power boost. They're the only vehicle that can do that, that grapples. So we talked to them. We talked to them quite a bit about payload operations for external payloads. I don't get a lot of time with EVA, mostly because we're never going to be doing EVAs and bringing in a visiting vehicle at the same time. But we do make sure that our vehicles are in a safe config for what's called the inhibit pad before they go outdoors. And that's just ensuring that we're not going to fire any jets at them or, you know, get the crew in a position around our vehicle that's not safe.
Can you explain what you meant by power boost with the arm?
So they can, when they capture through the particular grapple fixture that they have, we can provide power from the ISS. So we can switch the power system on the Cygnus from their solar arrays only and batteries only to providing power like we would if they were actually plugged in with a cable once they get to their node position or wherever they're going to be berthed for the duration. So we apply power to them through the robotics arm fairly early, and then they're all charged up and in a great position by the time we actually get them berthed, whereas the other vehicles don't necessarily have that capability. They're wanting to be on ISS power a lot longer before their batteries are fully charged.
I like to think of it as a robotics extension cord.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Okay. I was going to ask, with VVO, not all spacecraft are the same. Can you explain the difference, of course, between berthing and docking? And then who are you working with most with berthing operations?
Yeah, so a lot of the difference between berthing and docking is just at the very end, right? The vehicle still has to get from the ground all the way to the space station. And so, you know, 95% of that's going to look the same, but that 5% really matters. And so for grappling, a vehicle comes up underneath the space station and it hangs out about 25, 30 feet away. And then we have our robo friends come in and they do the actual, they train the crew to do the actual grappling operation. And so pre-flight, robos and VVOs work together a lot because we've got the crew using robo system monitoring. And then at some point, they go from watching to doing. And that handover has to be very fluid and has to be very well rehearsed. And so we work on training the crew together with the robos so that that transition happens very smoothly. And then for docking, the vehicle goes off course all the way to contact on its own under very fine control. And so that's all everybody watching, because at that point, you can't afford any level of delay, so you don't want to interface with the vehicle at all because it's, you know, tracking to inches to make contact happen successfully.
I like how you had mentioned working with robo. I was just going to ask robo for berthing, you know, operations like with Cygnus. You're working closely with VVO, and you know, we mentioned that you train the crew to grapple it and to grab it and, you know, park it at space station. You're on console there to support if needed, right? Has there ever been a case that you needed to jump in and help?
Yeah, definitely. We are monitoring very closely for mission control when the crew is doing robotic operations, especially something as dynamic as a visiting vehicle capture. We do train the crew to have some memorized responses using what we call a free flyer capture cue card. If something does go wrong and there's no comm with mission control for whatever reason, they have certain things that they can execute to put ISS and put the vehicle in a safe config. We can jump in if we need to. If it's, you know, more of a complex failure and we can handle it from the ground, then we're able to take over and tell the crew their job is done for the day. After they've grappled it, we do take over from the ground for the actual installation process, working closely with VVO and also very closely with OSO, who does the common berthing mechanism operation. So from the ground, we'll maneuver the vehicle, right next to station, right in front of where the vehicle is going to be installed. And we work, closely with OSO to get it installed at the CBM itself.
We had NASA astronaut Don Pettit on the show a few episodes back, and of course he's on the International Space Station now. And one of his stories I really like was he was the first one to grapple or to capture the cargo Dragon. And that's when Dragon was actually, it berths instead of autonomously docking. And now he's on Space Station again and sees it full circle where that vehicle has evolved and now it docks on its own. Which I thought was just kind of full circle and really cool. Last night, he posted a really cool video of Dragon departing space station. You got to check it out. Over to EVA, throw you into the mix. Can you tell us how closely you're working with Robo on day of EVA?
Yeah, so as Alyssa mentioned, sometimes we do get to work together really closely. So there are some EVAs that we can accomplish without the use of the robotic arm, but there's a lot of things on the space station that we just can't reach without using the robotic arm as basically a big tripod to hold the crew members in place so that they can actually reach what they need to. So for those EVAs, we identify that months out and we create our plan for the EVA with our robotics counterparts. And the iROSAs was a great example of that. So we figured out we need to bring these big solar arrays halfway across station and install them in a place where we don't have the means to do so otherwise. So we figured out a plan for how to carry those big heavy objects out there and how to safely get them where we needed to. And then we trained the crew members on board to operate the arm concurrently with the EVA happening, which is really cool. And we actually have some ways that we can do that training simultaneously in VR, where we have two crew members with VR headsets on, and they're actually holding onto this mass simulator where it feels like they're holding the real solar arrays. Except there's just motors moving this little box that they're holding. And then there's other crew members at a robotics console simulating moving the robotic arm. And as they move that, it'll change how that mass simulator moves. So we get to practice all of that choreography happening at once. We do also have a robotic arm in the NBL, so we can practice some of those motions. But the geometry is a little bit different since we're in a pool instead of a real big 3D space station. So the combination of those two tools really helps us train everyone beforehand. And then day of the EVA, we have the crew members on board the station flying the robotic arm during the EVA. While in mission control, Robo and EVA are supporting, watching, making sure everything's going as planned and ready to respond if there's issues.
You guys have naturally full circle gone back to how each other works with each other on console. I really liked your mention of the extension cord. So question to everyone, what other support do you all have when you're supporting these dynamic operations? Back rooms?
Yeah, absolutely. We at the VVO console, we have three different back rooms. I mentioned that we're in charge of trajectory, and also there are some systems on the vehicle we care about that are related, and of course, crew monitoring. And so that's a lot of information. And kind of as EVA mentioned, we kind of split that in half. And so we've got a console called VV Support that's looking more at systems and following the crew and looking at the timeline. And then we've got a position called VVP, VV Profile, and that's the trajectory that the vehicle is following. And so that's how we split in the back room with both of those people reporting up. And then we have a unique position called Arrow. And Arrow goes out to our provider's control center. So they'll go out to SpaceX, they'll go to Russia, they'll go to Japan. And so they provide an interface opportunity out there. And so it's nice because it provides back to NASA information about what's going on at the provider's control center. But Arrow also gives the provider some insight into what's going on at NASA. And so they've been in mission control. They know what they're thinking. They know what kind of information we want to hear. And so it's really about integrating, and it's about helping both sides efficiently communicate information and get where we need to get as quickly as possible.
Anyone else with the backrooms? You see the person on console, but you don't realize how much is going on behind the scenes at the same time.
So we also have a back room who provides systems level expertise to us for very specific dynamic operations. They're called Vega. And then we work closely with the provider control rooms as well. We have a counterpart or two in each of the various control rooms that we work very closely with. And then again, we have the Arrow. If we needed some support from Arrow, we can, you know, have them run some stuff down for us, but we work very closely with the different visiting vehicle providers as well.
Dory, I meant to ask you, what is Arrow an acronym?
It is, yeah. Ascent Entry Rendezvous Officer.
Got it. Okay, which makes very much sense that you'd be working together with them. And what about Vega?
You know, I'm not actually sure it has a name. I would have to look it up. I don't think it has an acronym. I don't think it stands for anything. We just called it Vega. I don't know.
It does sound cool. Yeah. Okay. And then how about when something unexpected happens? Anything from a spacesuit issue to receiving some incorrect information from a spacecraft? How do all of your teams work together? And does it go back to those back rooms and working with them?
And yeah, I'll add that Robo will always have three flight controllers on console, no matter the operation we're doing. We have the front room flight controller Robo, and then we have an MSS system. So MSS is mobile servicing system. And then we have an MSS task. When we see a failure on console, the MSS systems, they're kind of in charge. They're the technical expert of the group. And so they're kind of in charge of looking at troubleshooting and recovery, and they'll lead that effort. Our MSS task, their role is, well, MSS systems a little more heads down. They are keeping up with the calls on the flight loop, coordinating with other back rooms, keeping an eye on what crew's doing, making sure we're not missing any activities there. And then Robo kind of serves as the final independent check of MSS systems. Once we have a plan together, they're working very closely to make sure it makes sense for the configuration that we're in, the objective of the day. Very different if it's an EVA day versus if we're just maneuvering the arm to get into a park position. That'll definitely influence what our forward plan might be.
Got it. Okay.
And one thing I think that's common for all of us when things go wrong is we do a lot of training beforehand. We do flight controller simulations where we practice when things break or when things don't go our way. And we exercise all of the contingency procedures that we've made ahead of time. And for EVA, there are some situations with the spacesuit where the crew needs to act immediately, and they have these memorized responses that we always train them for during their NBL training and here on the ground, so that if it happens on the real spacewalk, they can respond. And then there's other things where they might want some help from the ground team. For example, if their tethers get tangled, we might be able to point one of our cameras up at them and see where their tether is wrapped and talk them through how to undo that, or get their partner over there to take a look at them and help them out a little bit.
This all sounds like it takes a lot of training, special knowledge, and I want to get to that topic here real quick. Can you tell us about the training process to become certified, front room certified? And it might look a little bit different for each of your consoles, or does it look similar? Can you explain that?
I think generally speaking, it's fairly similar in that you do training towards, sometimes there's kind of an analyst role where you maybe provide technical support to the team, but you're not necessarily on console first. And then you train to sit in the back room. Sometimes at one of the seats, if you've got a back room like we do with two consoles, you train both of the seats so that you understand the full job. And we try to give people a chance to actually do that job too. So once you've trained it, actually work a couple missions and get to really experience it and reap the benefits of all that training. And then you transition to training for the front as well, so that you can work in the FICR. And one of the pieces we haven't talked about is that we also provide the training for those people that are doing the console work. And so sometimes you do it in a parallel path, or sometimes instead of doing flight control, you go do the training aspect of it. And so you're coming up with the cases that we're throwing at the teams to give them a hard time, and you're helping give them feedback afterwards, and you're doing quizzes and sign-offs on their technical knowledge. And so you've got kind of both pieces of that that happen for, I think, all disciplines.
Yeah, so when you're sitting in the front room, it's really important that you know exactly what your back room's job is. And that's why we start from the bottom up. They become experts in the system that they're being trained for in that particular system. And then they can take that knowledge forward to the front room, and especially for our position, see the bigger picture overall and understanding what they need from that person in the back room who's supporting them. So it's really important that they understand from the bottom up versus top down. And then, like, with Dory, we work very closely together between the two consoles, where we then go into a training mode and take the skills that we've learned as a front room and a back room, and start to apply those to our trainees, so that we have a well-rounded, well-balanced team.
And so for VBO and ICE, do you all, when you're getting certified and trained, do you do specifically to the vehicle or the spacecraft that's arriving, or do you kind of have a similar overarching training that covers all?
So we start with a generic training. We have taken a past vehicle that no longer flies, and we provide training on those simulations, and they learn the systems. From our standpoint, they learn the systems, they learn the skills that we're trying to implement on how to understand vehicle systems, how to understand a comm system, how to recognize issues and problems and solve those and react to them properly. And they train on that generic vehicle. And then once they've achieved their certification, they're assigned to a specific vehicle where they turn around and use those skills that they learned generically and say, here's what I care about in an electrical system in this vehicle, because I learned that in the generic thing. I care about this for the comm system. I care about this for the ECLIS system. And they learn those skills for that specific vehicle. And then once you've mastered that real vehicle, it's very easy to transition over to a different vehicle and become kind of a jack of all trades. But we do focus maybe on two or three vehicles because it's a lot of information. The crazy thing about our job is versus a core system is the core systems focus on their system for the ISS, and things may not change unless things are changing rapidly with an emergency. We get to do a new mission every time. We get to do a new vehicle, a new mission every time, and learn that vehicle. So we may, I do four vehicles. Dory probably does something similar like that, but we have lots of vehicles. So sometimes you can't do them all. But it's very similar across the board, what you need to know about each of them.
I was going to ask Robo, so is yours nuanced between the different agencies, between Canadian Space Agency and NASA? Do you have to go get trained up in Canada at their Mission Control Center?
So all of the training, flight controllers, NASA and CSA, we get the same training. And in fact, the Canadian flight controllers will come down to Houston for months or even years at a time to get their flight controller training. I only get to go up to Canada every now and then. I was there a few weeks ago, actually, for some training initiatives as well. But unfortunately, we don't get to go up there as much as they get to come down here. But yeah, we go through, a similar training flow where we are taking classes, doing a lot of studying, doing oral boards. And then, of course, we get to our simulation environments where our instructors are throwing all types of malfunctions and failures our way, and not just in our own system, but also in other people's systems. And we have to recognize how that might impact our system or the objective of the day. And I know, especially for Robo and EVA, historically, those are the two positions where it does take the longest to become a front room flight controller. So I've been here almost 7 years now, and I am just now in training for my front room flight control certification. And they're very complex systems, and I want to make sure I know all the ins and outs before I'm sitting in the front room. So yeah, like I mentioned earlier, I am doing a lot of training right now for my front room flight certification, and it'll be worth it. But right now I'm in the deep side of training, but it's fun, and I know it's making me a better flight controller and crew instructor at the end of the day.
Lucas was nodding his head at the a while to get front room certified with EVA
as
and Robo.
Alyssa mentioned, yes, the task and the system side of EVA are so fundamentally different in how we operate that you kind of start with one and then you work your way up. We actually start as instructors instead of flight controllers. So we learn how to train the crew, because it turns out that's a really good way to figure out if you know the knowledge, is to train other people.
And to do it in front of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and we'll have experienced instructors and flight controllers with us as we start that training to make sure that the crew members get the training that they need, because we don't always nail it right away, believe it or not. But once we get some practice being instructor, figuring out all of the really good skills that the astronauts have to have, that's when we start getting into the flight control side, designing our own spacewalks and really focusing on specific missions. And once we do that as our backroom positions, either task or systems, and get a lot of experience doing that, then we start to cross train and learn the other side of the house. And once you're good enough in that, you can then move to the front room there. So for our group, it is closer to 8 to 10 years of being in this group before you get to be in the front room, which does take a long time. But again, they're very different and really, really important things that we want to make sure, like Alyssa said, that we really know all those little details and that we can make those real-time decisions quickly.
I think the common thread is that we all went to school and got technical degrees, but then we come here and we learn something very different or only somewhat related. You know, no one goes to school to learn how to teach people to fly the Canada Arm 2, right? And so even if you learn, for example, in school about trajectories, it's very uncommon to learn it from a relative perspective of where is one vehicle compared to another vehicle when they're both moving differently. And so we kind of assume that when people come in, we're going to have to teach them all those skills. And so as long as they are good at learning technical content. They don't have to come in with it. We can give it to them, but it does take time.
That was the perfect segue. I was going to ask, what steps for an aspiring flight controller would you recommend they take to prepare for any sort of role like this? You mentioned you might get a technical degree, but you're not going to learn how to, you know, work the robotic arm or support an EVA until you really get here. But through education, internships, and other opportunities, what would you recommend for folks to get here in your spots?
Yeah, I think obviously you have to have the ability to learn and understand technical content. And that's what getting a technical degree shows us, that you can learn the material, you learn how to learn while you're in college. But I think the hardest part after that is the soft skills, is the being able to communicate, is being able to see the big picture. It doesn't matter how much you know if you can't tell other people what you know and you can't make them understand what you know. And so that's a lot of what our generic training is about. Ice was mentioning that we train on a vehicle that doesn't fly anymore, but we're teaching you how to be a flight controller. We're teaching you how to look and put the pieces together, and how to talk to Robo about their system, and when to call Ice, and how to work together, and when one person takes over, and the idea of sometimes you're the leader and sometimes you're the support, and that ebb and flow. And that all requires a lot of soft skills that don't always get that specific training in college. And so that's a lot of really having to jump in and dive in and experience it to learn those things.
I was going to ask, do you all have any words of wisdom on those types of skills, soft skills, or how to succeed in a high pressure environment and making decisions quick? Do you have any words of wisdom on that?
I always suggest that people try to do things that maybe they're not super comfortable with. So for me, I don't think I was a great communicator or a great speaker in college. So that was something an organization I forced myself to do was be a tour guide at A&M. And I think that gave me great skills that I use every day here at my job. I didn't get those skills, you know, in my engineering classes. Maybe we had a presentation or two a semester, but not to the level that I needed when I came to NASA to have confidence to be able to speak clearly and concisely. So try to do things that you feel you need to work on. Because at the end of the day, like VVO said, right, we're getting those engineering skills and those science and technical skills in college, but maybe not so much the soft skills on the communication side.
Yeah, and for EVA, a lot of those apply. One of the biggest hurdles, as we kind of talked earlier, was we jump in as instructors and we're teaching astronauts very early in our careers here. And that kind of moment of, holy cow, how am I going to get this crazy experienced person to listen to me, you know, and hear what I have to say? And how am I actually going to help them? So that hurdle is an interesting one. And one of the biggest pieces of advice I got for that was you just have to get them to trust you, because you're not going to know everything. But if they ask a question that you don't know the answer to, saying, I don't know, but this is where I'll find out and I'll get you that answer, instead of guessing. Because a lot of times in college, you're incentivized to give your best guess and just put your best effort out, even when you aren't confident in that. But if you tell an astronaut something very confidently, and then it turns out you were wrong, they're not going to trust you anymore after that. So if you show them, hey, I know where my limits are, and I will still get you what you need to know without my limits being higher, right? That lets them trust you and then still be able to receive and learn from you, even though you're so early in your learning process yourself.
These are great examples, even for every day, not training to become a flight controller like all of you. Ice, did you have any words of wisdom?
I think a critical skill that people don't come out of college with that they need to learn is listening and being able to function and doing other things while listening. On console, we hear a lot of voices, a lot of conversations, and we're probably holding them at the same time. And we have to be able to listen to one conversation while still paying attention to another one, while maybe listening for the crew to call down and then everybody stops. But at the same time, you're taking notes and you're also researching this failure at the same time. And so multitasking and listening and learning how to hear all the things that are going around you really pushes you towards situational awareness. And that is a critical skill for everything you do on console. If you cannot parse out everything that's going on around you and stay focused on the task at hand, you're going to struggle in this job. And so we can see that pretty early in some of our flight controllers, whether they can do that or not.
think the other thing too is that you come out of college wanting to show people what you know, and you get exams and you're looking at test scores and whatever else. But spaceflight is a team sport. And so kind of understanding the concept that you don't want to try to impress people, and you will naturally by not doing that. So when you're doing your job well and you're filling in a support role when you need to, and you're standing up and taking a leadership role when you need to, and you're saying with confidence what you know and with honesty what you don't know, you impress people without ever thinking about yourself. And I think that is a big part in making the team work and in kind of changing your mindset when you move from college to doing flight control.
Thanks, VBO. Well, VBO, ICE, EVA, and Robo, I think we are just about out of time. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Houston, go ahead.
Stop of the space shuttle.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Shuttle has cleared the path.
It came at speed for all mankind.
It's actually a huge honor to break a record like this.
Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Never, Houston. Welcome to space.
Thanks for sticking around. I hope you learned something new today. This is the fifth in a series of podcasts we're recording that highlight the roles of all the different consoles in the International Space Station Mission Control. Check out our previous episodes to learn more about ISS control, communications, crew health, and schedule and inventory. And be on the lookout for the final Mission Control-centric episode coming soon. Our full collection of episodes is on nasa.gov/podcast. You can also find the many other wonderful podcasts we have across the agency. On social media, we're on the NASA Johnson Space Center pages of Facebook, X, and Instagram. Use hashtag AskNASA on your favorite platform to submit your idea or ask a question. Just be sure to mention it's for Houston, we have a podcast. This interview was recorded on December 17th, 2024. Thanks to Dane Turner, Will Flato, Daniel Tohelt, Courtney Beasley, and Dominique Crespo. Special thanks to Chelsea Bayarte, Jaden Jennings, and Flight Director Paul Kanya for helping us plan and set up these interviews. And of course, thanks again to Dori Tomiko, Lisa Harris-Redmond, Lucas Widener, and Alyssa Sines for taking the time to come on the show. Give us a rating and feedback on whatever platform you're listening to us on, and tell us what you think of our podcast. We'll be back next week.
3, 2, 1.
This is an official NASA podcast.